calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they're at it again. It's like no matter what, they're at it again. The Bush administration and the Food and Drug Administration. I'm telling you, the big difference between conservative morality and traditional American morality is that conservatives are interested in what people are doing in private, in their bedrooms, in their sex lives, what drugs they're taking in private. Anything you're doing in private, conservatives want to know about it. The traditional American morality, however, has been what's going on in public. Are there those among us who are hungry? Let's make sure that they're fed. Are those among us who are homeless? Let's make sure that they've got a place to live. Are there those among us who don't have opportunity in the workplace, who don't have a chance to get a job, who can't move themselves up in the economic world? Let's make sure that they have that opportunity. Are there those among us who, because of years and years of, for example, segregation or slavery, have had a difficult time getting into the economic middle class? Let's give them some bootstraps they can pull themselves up by. Let's bring them into the middle class. Traditional American morality it's not just grounded in Matthew 25 or the Sermon on the Mount. It's reflected in it as well, because I frankly think that this morality precedes Christianity, precedes Judaism, that it's as old as the human race itself. It's as old as humanity itself. It is the "we are here for us" notion. That is one of the ancient foundational notions of family, community, tribe, country, state, clan. I mean, you know, whatever name you slap on it, there are some things that we make sure that we are, that others of us are not harmed by. You know, we look out for predators, collectively. In the old days, it would be, you know, somebody would sit in the tree looking for the cougar coming through the forest. Today, it's the police department. Or it's the Food and Drug Administration, or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, looking out for predators. Now, what the Bush administration wants to do is they want to take that public good function, that classic American morality function, of "we're watching out for us," and they want to change it to the conservative morality function of "we're going to make sure that you're doing in your bedroom what we want you to do." Where I'm going with all this, Lester Crawford of the Food and Drug Administration announced a week or so ago, rather abruptly, many say, that he was retiring. Lester Crawford, the guy who brought us the FDA unwillingness to allow Plan B to be an over-the-counter drug, Plan B a day-after birth control device. No, it does not cause abortions. It prevents conception. You see, conception, from the time that somebody has sex until the time that sperm makes its way all the way up into the fallopian tubes and finds an egg and combines with it and forms the zygote, the very early stage, the fertilized egg, is typically about 3 days, 72 hours. And so if you take Plan B during those 72 hours, it throws the same birth control pill hormones into your bloodstream as if you had taken birth control pills in the first place, which cause the egg to reject the sperm, basically. Say, "Hey, no thanks. I'm not available. I've got a headache," or whatever. And so conception doesn't happen. It's not an abortion pill. It is a birth control pill. It works the same way that birth control pills that people take every single day work. Except this is for people who don't take birth control pills every single day. And, you know, maybe a condom broke, or maybe they're just, you know, not generally sexually active, or, you know, maybe it was an impulsive, maybe they've been raped. Plan B, if taken within 72 hours, prevents conception. Lester Crawford fought tooth and nail to keep this thing out of the public marketplace. And so he's leaving, and the guy who's replacing him, Herr Dr. Andre von Eschenbach, who is, now if you read all the news reports, all the national news reports, Herr von Eschenbach is merely the head of the National Cancer Institute. What they don't tell you in the news reports is that not only is he the head of the National Cancer Institute, but that he is a Bush appointee to the National Cancer Institute. One more, another example of taking what should be a protective, bless you, Valerie, thank you, a protective function of government. One more example of taking, you know, part of that public morality. We're here to protect ourselves. We're here to look out for ourselves. Taking that and turning it into that conservative private morality, we're going to use this institution to make sure that in your bedroom, in your privacy, you're doing what we think you should do and you're not doing what we think you shouldn't. And here's how it worked at the National Cancer Institute when von Eschenbach was the director. Well, he still is. Within months, as they say over the blog, Nico posted on the blog over at thinkprogress.org, within months of von Eschenbach's appointment to director of the National Cancer Institute, this was 2.5 years ago, the Institute abruptly altered a fact sheet on its website that for years stated that there was no link between abortion and breast cancer. In fact, there is no link between abortion and breast cancer. The New England Journal of Medicine, for example, published a study of 1.5 million women looking for any sort of relationship between women having had an abortion and women having breast cancer later in life. No link. None. But Herr Dr. von Eschenbach, I shouldn't call him that. He's an American, and I shouldn't make German jokes. I lived in Germany for a year. I guess it's in any case. Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, I would imagine, anglicized. What he did was he changed the language on the National Cancer Institute's website, where they've got a page that says, you know, here are the things that make it more likely for you to get cancer, breast cancer. Here are the things that make it less likely for you to get breast cancer. Here are the things that have no effect on breast cancer. They changed that website to say that having had an abortion, whether it's, you know, whether it has an impact or not on breast cancer, is inconclusive. There was a huge stink at the National Cancer Institute. Because, I mean, this is an organization made up of scientists whose job is to use science to protect us from those things that would harm us, like cancer. After all, it's the National Cancer Institute. Over 100 of the scientists within the institute published a public statement asking von Eschenbach to change the website, the fact sheet for the National Cancer Institute, to be consistent with what science said. Finally, he backed down. So George W. Bush, when Lester Crawford says he's leaving, the anti-Plan B guy, George W. Bush says, I have just the man to replace him. Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach. And curiously, interestingly, and, you know, kind of fascinating, really, when you dig into it, is that not a single story, as far as we can tell. Well, okay, here, there is a beginning, well, Christian Newswire, that's not quite the same. Very few stories in the mainstream media. I'm looking through these. There's the PR Web, Megadeth. Yeah, none of the, you know, you look for New York Times, Washington Post, the National, not a single national newspaper, there's not one here, that points out that Eschenbach has been involved in this breast cancer controversy. Nobody's talking about it. You know, is this going to be the story that we're not going to hear? Like the story about John Roberts going down in 2000 and helping George W. Bush and James Baker steal an election from Al Gore? Is this going to be the story that you're not going to hear? The seminal role that John Roberts played in being a partisan hack for the Republican Party and for George W. Bush in helping the lawyers figure out how to successfully argue before the Supreme Court that the vote count in Florida should be suspended and George W. Bush should be installed as president, even if Al Gore got more votes? That was the argument they made before the Supreme Court. And by the way, they did win. And many Republicans will tell you they won because John Roberts went down and trained him. He taught him how. He was Rehnquist's clerk. He knew how the court worked. As a lawyer, he's one of the leading lawyers in the United States to take courses, cases before the Supreme Court. He knows how to do it. The story, that story didn't get told. Is the new FDA chief story not going to get told? When is this administration going to start worrying about the public good and not just private profit? 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The Psycho Cowboy, yippee-yi, whoopee-whoopee-tie, whoopee-whoopee-tie, hey, don't you? Don't run, run away.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Don't forget the Million Phone March to stop John Roberts, millionphonemarch.com. Just check it out. MillionPhoneMarch.com. You can plug in your state, get the phone numbers for your senators, and call and let them know, hey, John Roberts doesn't represent me on the Supreme Court. Please do not vote for him. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here. Our program this hour brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, for all things Macintosh. At the bottom of the hour, Kenny Ossibel is going to be with us. We're going to be talking about the Bioneers Conference coming up. Kenny's an award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and social entrepreneur. At the top of the next hour, we're going to be talking with Michael Ratner. Michael is one of the folks who initiated a lawsuit against our notable, redoubtable, whatever, Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld. And I want to ask the question, is it constitutional that we have, or is it legal even, that we have armed mercenaries patrolling the streets of New Orleans? That, you know, you've got Blackwater in New Orleans. What's the deal here with this thing? And so we'll get into that. That'll be in the third hour of our program. But this being the first hour of our program. Let's see. Oh, and David Swanson's going to be with us at the bottom of this hour in about 15 minutes. Talking about what happened. David was there yesterday when Cindy was arrested. He's been in Washington, D.C. throughout the protests. So that should be fascinating as well. So lots going on, lots of, interesting things, as they say in the business. Is money, the larger issue that I started to set up is the question of, is money more important than humans? And the answer from a conservative point of view, and this is an old argument that goes back a long way, by the way, is yes, property value, property rights trump human rights in the conservative worldview. See, this is about understanding the difference between the conservative worldview and the traditional American worldview. The conservative worldview, private morality is more important than public morality. The traditional American worldview, public morality is more important than private morality. The traditional conservative worldview, personal property is more important and profit is more important than the health of society or individual lives, for that matter. You can kill to protect your property. You can take a life to protect something lifeless. That's the conservative worldview. The traditional American worldview has been that you can only kill to protect life. That, you know, if you feel that you are personally threatened, you can kill somebody. If your home is threatened, you can't. And it's a very significant dividing line. And what we're seeing played out, for example, right now, the toxic waste dumps down in St. Bernard Parish, it's turning into an enormous toxic waste dump. And there are those who are suggesting, for example, that the EPA is lying to the people of New Orleans and to all of us about how dangerous or non-dangerous it may be, about, you know, the consequences of the flooding down there. Why would they do that? Well, because they represent an administration that puts property values and corporate profits ahead of human life, frankly. They're not pro-life, to put it very simply. The same thing with the multinational drug companies. I don't know if you saw the movie The Constant Gardener. Louise and I went to see this movie the weekend before last. And it's actually based on a true story. The true story is about a kid named Kano in northern Nigeria. I'm sorry, Kano is the city in northern Nigeria. Anas is the kid's name. And a pharmaceutical company came to town to try out a new drug. It was called Trovan. He took the drug, and he now has such terrible joint pain that he can't play. He can't participate. One of them, a solemn faced boy named Anas, sits quietly watching as his friends are kicking a football. He cannot play because he has pains in his knees that prevent him from running. Well, this is how they discovered that this thing has this nasty side effect. They went to Africa. They gave it to poor people. Well, they're just poor people in Africa. As Barbara Bush would say, they were underprivileged to begin with. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's ironic you brought that up because I put in a tape in 76 Democratic vice presidential when Mondale gave his acceptance speech. And so ironic you brought that up. It was on my mind, if you don't mind. That he said there's much more to America than property and inherited wealth.
Yeah, well, not if you're talking to a Republican. That's the bottom line. Tom DeLay saying there's nothing more important in time of war than tax cuts.
And it's so ironic you brought that up. I mean, it's another coincidence. A few comments, if I may, appreciate it. That democracy, it seems to me that democracy, this is my own thoughts, and freedom, it's just not guaranteed. We need to work at it harder, and especially when we go vote.
Yeah, it's not a matter
of guaranteed.
No, it's not, Gary, and it's not a matter of whether or not there's a constitutional guarantee for it. It's that there are forces out there that want to take it away from us. It's that simple. I mean, it's very, very simple. The Bush administration is all about limiting individual freedom. They're all about telling women whether or not they can get an abortion. They're all about telling people what religion it's all about limiting individual freedom. And that's not the American way. That's not the traditional American way. Traditionally, Americans have been about expanding freedom. You got Justice Scalia. He came to the Vermont Law School a year or so ago when I was living in Vermont. Gives this speech. He says, "You want rights? Pass a law. You got to pass a law to have a right. I'm sorry, it's the other way around. If you want to intentionally limit rights, if we all want to agree that we're going to stop at red lights, then you pass a law." But no, you're absolutely right, Gary. If we want to have freedom and democracy in the United States, we have to participate in the political process. We have to get active and we have to stay active because there are people out there, by and large, who call themselves conservatives who aggressively want to take away your rights and mine. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Maybe you do want to know what's going on. Yeah, the FDA, they're giving it away. George Bush, he's saying, don't travel too much, but he's flying around in his airplane that costs $6,000 an hour to fly. $6,029, actually. That's just for the fuel. Just for the gas. But it's so important to get those photo ops in because, after all, his numbers are in the tank. I mean, you've got to figure what's really vital travel here and what isn't. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Yeah, hey. First of all, Michael Brown is on C-SPAN for those who are interested. He may be done, but they're having the hearings on what went right or what went wrong.
Yeah, I heard he was on a little earlier, and the news report was basically he's trying to shift the blame to the state and local officials.
Yep, and then secondly, this all kind of ties into the confirmation of John Roberts because, not only just voting, but the people that disgruntled with federal programs, health care, jobs, all of this stuff, corporate personhood, this all ties into his confirmation. And any Democrat who's equivocating on this, the people should actually give them give them peace of their mind just so that they can understand just what this all means to we the people.
Absolutely. And for them to know, including folks who I have tremendous respect for, like Russ Feingold and Pat Leahy, I am still baffled why they say that they're going to vote in favor of this guy. And I still think that probably their minds can be changed if enough people call. The telephone number on Capitol Hill, the actual, hardwired phone number, 202-225-3121 to say no to Judge Roberts, and the toll-free number, 888-888, that is, 355-3588, 888-355-3588. So thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you there. Bill in Oregon on the line. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Bill?
I'm glad to hear it. Love your show.
Thank you.
Just a comment about this paramilitary people.
Yeah, we're gonna have a guest on at the bottom of the next hour talking just about that. Yes, your comment.
Yeah, well, there's more than one. I was had to go pick up a load out of the convention center after they opened up part of it a
in
couple
New Orleans
weeks ago.
Uh huh.
New Orleans, and I went out and met these great guys in little black SUVs that escorted us into the convention center, and they were wearing, you know, more ammunition clips than they did clothes on, and it was Tactical Intervention, TII was the name of the company, and they've been in Iraq, and they've been in a couple of other places.
Yeah.
And
these guys are all Schwarzenegger wannabes, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they were nice guys, but it was definitely a little strange to walk in there, and I go into the convention center, and there's must be 300, they've used it as a staging area for the National Guard, so there's 300 National Guardsmen sitting around taking breaks and stuff there, which is not to take away from their work, but, you know, they're on site. And these guys are just sitting around watching us getting loaded and getting unloaded and getting paid big bucks.
Right. Yeah. And you wonder who's paying it and how that money is flowing and who are the directors of these corporations and what's their relationship to the Bush administration and, you know, what kind of cronyism is going on here. Bill, thanks for the tip.
Hey, you're welcome.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Dave, the trucker in South Carolina. Dave, what's up?
No, it's Steve. How are you doing?
Oh, Steve. I'm sorry.
My name's Steve. Hey, just a little aside. I mean, before the FBI, it was basically the FBI was the Pickering Detective Agency.
Well, my understanding is that actually the two big Pinkerton and Pickering, the big private detective agencies, actually were started back in the late 19th century to bust up unions.
Well,
I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that was the case with Pinkerton anyway.
Well, they went after the James Gang. Basically, they were...
Oh, so they were bounty hunters then?
They were the de facto FBI back then.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
But head of the Pickering was also in charge of intelligence during the Civil War.
Oh.
So for the Union.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's just an aside. You know, I'm a Republican with libertarian leanings. Right. And I guess the basic constitutional difference I have with you is, right, I kind of agree with Scalia, right? I wouldn't mind if some drugs were legalized, prostitution being legalized, right? But get the votes to do it. It's not a constitutional right. The same with abortion. They pull that out of whole cloth, right? I'm against abortion because I can point to a victim. I mean, I got a basic rule. If you can point to a victim, pass the law. To me, abortion, I can point to a victim.
So let's go. Let's just back up here a little bit. You're saying that you're in favor of decriminalizing drugs and prostitution. Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Well,
do you find a right in the Constitution to take drugs?
Nope.
Okay. Do you find a right in the Constitution to hire a prostitute?
Nope.
But both those things were legal at the time of the founding of this country. What does that tell you about the Constitution?
Well, what I'm saying is if you want to pass laws against it, I would vote.
No, no, what Scalia said was if you want a right, pass a law.
Well,
this is the big difference between Scalia and Thomas on the one side and the other seven justices on the Supreme Court, or now six with Rehnquist dead. But even Rehnquist was opposed to that idea. All the other seven justices and every other justice in the history of the Supreme Court has said you don't pass laws to grant rights. You pass laws to restrict rights.
No, no, we pass laws to restrict rights. I'm saying we pass laws to restrict rights. And I don't consider prostitution a right. I mean, but
well, of course it's a right. All kinds of behavior, all forms of behaviors are rights, and what
okay,
we do is we pass laws to limit them. There's no right to chew food in the Constitution either, but you can do it.
It's not a constitutional right, right? Very few people might argue that it is, but I'm just saying.
You're confusing the issue, Dave. The constitutional rights are those rights that govern. They're limits on government activity. They're not limits on human activity.
Well,
the whole point, no, the whole, seriously, think about this for a minute. The whole point of the Bill of Rights was to limit government intervention. The government shall not create a religion. Government shall not interfere with printing presses. Government shall not forbid people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances.
Okay,
government shall not quarter soldiers in their homes.
Those are all rights, right? I will give you, those are all rights, right?
Those are not rights. Those are restrictions on government behavior.
Okay, but how does, well, I mean, I'm just saying, if you want to try to make the argument, for example, that prostitution is a constitutional right, you have a constitutional right.
I'm saying is that there's no such thing as a constitutional right. This is, you really ought to go read Federalist 87, written by another conservative, Alexander Hamilton.
Okay, let me rephrase this, and you're probably right. Let me rephrase this, right? A judge should not say there's a constitutional right to be a prostitute, right? But, right, I'm a libertarian. I would vote that way, right? I don't want the courts to do it. I would vote that way on...
Yeah, you know, I get your point, Dave. Your point is, and your point is well taken, actually. And it's one of the arguments that if it was in a vacuum, it's one of the conservative arguments against abortion that seems to make sense, which is, we had passed laws against this, so that was the will of the people. This is a democracy, and therefore, because that's the will of the people, judges shouldn't be inserting themselves into this process and saying, I don't care what the people say, you can't have a law against abortion. Now, the problem with that is that there are some areas where we say that because humans have higher rights than property, and because we respect human rights in the United States, that there are some fundamental rights, and I know where you're going with this, yeah, what about the fetus? But nonetheless, there are some human rights that transcend the public opinion. For example, the right of African Americans to be part of society. That transcends public opinion. If you were to say, as Robert Bork tried to say, that when the Supreme Court said in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education that they could force busing, they could force integration, that was wrong, then we would still have apartheid in the United States. If you were to say, as Robert Bork tried to say, that the Supreme Court would have no place to say women should be allowed to vote. In fact, it wasn't the court that did it, but nonetheless, then
Well, that was a constitutional amendment. That was an amendment.
That's right, and you're right. That wasn't a court case, but Roe v. Wade actually was reversing a court case. In 1873, the court ruled that women only have rights through their husbands or fathers. In the case in 1873.
Okay, that still don't give you a right to an abortion. I mean, I'm coming in from the other end. I mean, I came into this world under not the best of conditions.
Dave, I understand what you're saying, and I'm just not going to argue abortion. This is an argument that just like never ends. It really just never ends. The bottom line is the Supreme Court said in the first trimester, it's not yet a viable human being, and therefore you can have an abortion. The second and third trimester, we can argue about it. Essentially, that's what the Supreme Court said. And you can argue the Supreme Court was making law when they said that, because they created a definition that didn't exist at law. And that's an arguable point. But it is, that is how the courts have ruled, and they have said that this has to do with the right of the mother, the living, breathing mother, to decide what happens in her body. And to the extent that there's not a viable human being. And what this all gets down to, what this all boils down to, is the argument that Catholics have been having with everybody forever. Well, not forever, actually only since the 1850s, when Catholics outlawed abortion. Prior to that, abortion was just fine with the Vatican. And that argument is, when does life begin? Because the Bible says life begins when a baby draws its first breath. And the Catholics say, no, life begins when somebody actually starts thinking about having sex, which is why they're opposed to birth control as well. So, it's like, where does it be? And it's an argument that'll never end, as I said. But my take on it is, as a man, I have no right to tell a woman what she can do with her body. You want to put it up for a plebiscite, I'll only allow women to vote on it. Don't allow men to vote on. And we'll see where it goes. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
When sundown pales the sky, I want want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I'd look, your eyes would find.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. David Swanson is with us. David is the founder of AfterDowningStreet.org. David was with Cindy Sheehan yesterday when she got arrested, and give us a report. Or was it day before? No, it was yesterday she got arrested, wasn't it, David?
It was yesterday, early afternoon, 384 people, myself not among them, got arrested in front of the White House. Military parents, grandparents, veterans, ministers, rabbis, professors, relatively old crowd, not too many young people, really. 384 people got packed into Metro buses and a few police vans, buses which showed up much faster than any bus got to New Orleans, and were hauled off to a D.C. police station, and the last of them got out at 4:30 this morning. You know, they just turned them loose in this neighborhood where you can't find a bus or a cab in the daytime, you know, and so...
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that Cindy Sheehan is saying that she has a court date in November, and it's a $75 fine for demonstrating without a license, but she's going to say that this is unconstitutional.
Yeah, most of the people, my understanding is, are going to pay the $75. A lot of them are from Texas or California or Oregon, and they're not going to make the trip back to challenge. But at least 20 people, including Cindy, are going to challenge it in court or go to jail. And, you know, the charge is demonstrating without a permit. And what these people did was sit down on the sidewalk in front of the White House and sing songs. And they're going to argue that is constitutionally defensible.
Now, the First Amendment of the Constitution says Congress shall pass no laws limiting the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition their government for redress of grievances. And so their argument is that this falls into that category. The argument of the city of Washington, D.C., or of the Bush administration, one or the other, would be that if you want to peaceably assemble and petition the government for a right of redress, you have to do it in a free speech zone behind barbed wire, out of sight of George W. Bush.
Well, they'll argue that there are laws saying if you have more than five people, you need a petition and you need a permit, and that otherwise you're not allowed to stop and sit down, and that they warned everybody three times and then arrested them. But I think regardless of how the court cases go, a very powerful message was made yesterday that this is a majority opinion and that many people from all walks of life...
You mean
life
the majority of Americans?
Majority of Americans, yeah. Well, the rest of the world's way out ahead of us, but the majority of Americans have come around, and that many of them are willing to sacrifice for this, and this will not be the last of these protests at the White House.
Yeah. Will in Washington, D.C. is with us, too. Will, you were at the rally and you were just released?
Good morning, Speaker of Truth. Yes, I was.
Okay, you're on live with David Swanson. What happened, Will?
Good morning. Oh, well, it was a little bit rough. I guess I talked too much, and they kept me in the paddy wagon instead of the bus. It's a little bit bumpy of metal in there, but about 5-6 hours later, when we finally got put into the cell and stuff, the girls in the pink crew,
Code Pink.
Yes, sir. They were putting out some major music in the cell for a couple hours before we got... run through and started going down the line to go through all the different steps. So,
mm-hmm. Are you going to fight it or are you going to pay the $75?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I woke up this morning, like I said, somebody put me up for the night and I couldn't find my ticket, so I'll have to think about that one.
Okay. Well, good on you, Will. Congratulations on... go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just said thank you so much for you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And thanks so much for having the courage to stand up and speak your mind there in Washington, D.C. I think civil disobedience has a long and extraordinary history. I mean, without civil disobedience, if we were to say, oh, people don't have the right to sit down and passively resist the machine, we would still have segregation in the United States. India would still be part of England, et cetera, et cetera. It's a... David Swanson, is a website being created in defense of Cindy's lawsuit, as it may be, or her taking this thing to the Supreme Court?
I don't know, but there certainly are several websites already created, up and running, supporting this effort, including UnitedForPeace.org and AfterDowningStreet.org and MeetWithTheMothers.org, which is the website that Cindy set up to push for lobbying Congress. To
what happened to with meetwithcindy.org?
Meetwithcindy.org is still around, but we sort of directed people from it to the bus tour website that's now over and to the Meet with the Mothers website. And
Meet with the Mothers?
Meetwiththemothers.org, which is where you can find out how to lobby your Congress member to come around to the majority opinion of the people and stop the war.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good on you. David Swanson with AfterDowningStreet.org. Thanks for the report, David.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Keep up the great work out there.
You too.
Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 56 minutes past the hour, about 4 minutes before the hour. Jamila in Eureka, California. Hey, Jamila, we have about a minute left. What's up?
Good morning, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
You were talking about Constitution and passing rights. And,
yes.
And you said you pass laws to restrict rights.
Yes.
You don't pass law to give rights.
Right.
And I think it is the biggest difference between free country and dictatorship.
Yes, I agree. It's also a difference in, you know, there's differences like this between our form of government and some others, like in France, for example. You know, you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent, or it used to be, the old Napoleonic Code. And here you're innocent until they prove you guilty, for example.
Yeah, there used to be a joke about it in communist country, and it went like, what is the difference between United States and Soviet Union? In United States, everything that is not banned is allowed. In Soviet Union, everything that is not allowed is banned.
Yeah, and it's not a joke, Jamila. You're absolutely right.
It is tragic.
Yeah, and that's the direction that John Roberts and Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas want to take this country, and George W. Bush, of course, as well. Well said. Well said. Thank you for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
Great to hear from you.
Bye.
I appreciate it. So, you know, what do you want? Do you want a nation where if you want a right, you have to pass a law? To quote Justice Scalia, by the way, go to TomHartman.com, click Articles on Democracy. You can see the article that I wrote based on that and quoting Scalia. And there's his quote. Or do you want a nation where we have rights and we restrict them with laws? You decide.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.TomHartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. First of all, I want to thank you for The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. It's a terrific book, and I recommend it. It's easy reading, but full of information.
Well, thank you.
And I compliment you on your language, and I'd like to just make a small statement about language. Conservatives are very interested in language, and they frame issues with it. And you mentioned last hour human rights and property rights.
Right.
And property rights are a framing of the conservative movement. Property can't have any rights. People can have interest in property. There are property interests, but there are no property rights.
Right. And in fact, back in the 18th century, in the 1700s, you read, for example, Jefferson's writings and his lengthy correspondences with Madison about these issues and when they were drafting the Constitution in 1787. And at that time, they referred to it as personality interests. And personality interests was the phrase that today we would call wealth.
Wealth. Yeah. Well, I'm not very acquainted with wealth myself.
Yeah. But in any case, just as an FYI, I thought that was interesting. Bob, thanks for the point. Well
All
said.
Right.
Thank you very much. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to know if you have tried to contact Leahy yourself to try to talk to him.
Yes.
And he won't talk to you?
No, he's not available.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just looking on the Democratic Underground, and I posted a thing about everyone's got to call Leahy. And a lot of people said, well, you know, that same old baloney that, you know, well, we could save the fight for, you know, the next one.
That's nonsense.
It's insane.
If George Washington had said that, we would still be a colony of England. Yes. Oh, I think I'll wait for the next battle. Maybe I can win that. I'm sorry. You fight every battle, even the ones that you might lose. You fight every battle.
Absolutely. And it's just insane. Yeah. I was thinking maybe a strategy might be for us to start calling, like, Kennedy and Kerry and Boxer and tell them to talk to Leahy.
Well, you know, it's not going to get you anywhere. We need to be calling Leahy. It's very simple.
Okay.
202-225-3121 or toll-free 888-355-3588.
Yeah, I'm posting that all over the Internet, every place I can, and it's
great.
All over the Democratic Underground. Thanks,
good.
Tom.
Good on you. Thanks a lot, Amy. Good to hear from you. Ann in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Ann.
Hi, it's no surprise that Brown, you know, who was criticized from running the way they ran FEMA in the New Orleans hurricane situation, is now saying it wasn't FEMA's responsibility to come in and be the first responders and everything.
Of course it wasn't. But why did they in Florida, why, you know, a year ago and 2 years ago and 3 years ago and 5 years ago, and why did they in Texas last week?
Well, in Texas, there's a good article in yesterday's Houston Chronicle that a local judge told the local authorities, that if they've got enough police officers to go take supplies from FEMA,
right,
do it, because FEMA's not cutting the red tape.
Yeah, but I saw
that's
that.
That's not really why I called. I was thinking all this incompetence was just Bush and his administration's incompetence, but now I'm starting to wonder if it's incompetence with a reason, because Bush has been calling for military intervention in situations.
Yes.
And then I read a very interesting article last night, supposedly contributed to somebody that wrote it for the Washington Post, about Pentagon's secret operation Granite Shadow. Have you heard of that?
No, but I'll make a note of it.
Granite Shadow supposedly is a military operation in the U.S. where they get that they're planning to put military people in to take over control if there's emergency situations over U.S. citizens without any supervision or control by any civilian.
Yeah, okay, I have it now. Yes, there's a piece in the Washington Post about it. Okay, let me learn
really
some more.
Scary.
It is, Ann, and this is something I was gonna get into today. George W. But we'll do it tomorrow instead. David will be on that today as well. The whole thing, the Army is trained to kill people and blow things up. That's what the military is all about. It's about killing people and blowing things up. And if instead you want to protect people's rights and you want to do things by the rule of law, that's why you have police. And they have completely different training than military. And the fact that Bush is saying, oh, let's just bring in the military whenever we have a disaster, just illustrates the stupidity of having a CEO as a president instead of somebody who at least had some training in the law. I think pretty much most all of our previous presidents were lawyers previously, and they understood the difference, at least between the functions of an army and the functions of a police department, or the functions of emergency services. And it's just, this is a very dangerous president. Kenny Ossibel is with us. He's a founder of Bioneers, bioneers.org, the website. They've got a great conference every year, one coming up here in October in California. Bioneers.org, you can get more information about it. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What are the main topics that are going to be covered at the Bioneers Conference this year?
Well, you know, it's all over the map, but we're going to be very strong, of course, on global warming, which we had already planned, and reframing green chemistry, which is a field that we're all going to see explode very soon. It's already well underway, and, you know, just witnessing, of course, what's happened in the Gulf now, which is the dark matrix, you know, of the toxic familiar of the chemical industry.
Yeah.
Obviously, we just have to do things really, really differently. And so there's going to be a very interesting group of scientists who are at the forefront of green chemistry, because nature operates very differently from how we operate. It uses very few chemicals as opposed to lots of them. And, of course, they're harmless when they're in the right combination. So that's a field to watch.
In other words, there's alternatives to the kind of chemistry that is producing all the waste material down in Louisiana that's now covering the city of New Orleans.
There's alternatives that are not only superior from an environmental and health point of view, but they're actually cheaper. The whole thing is cheaper. And, you know, nature operates. The conventional technology is what's called heat, beat, and treat. You know, you use very high temperatures, high pressures, and then process this stuff with all kinds of nastiness. And nature operates at room temperature in water, mm-hmm. and has very, very simple combinations of just a few chemicals and elements. And it's worked for, 3.8 billion years pretty well till we came along.
Yeah. So, what about solar energy? George Bush is saying, everybody drive less, as if, those people who have to actually drive to work, have a choice this week. But he's not going to talk about light rail or infrastructure as he's flying around on Air Force One telling us not to use fuel. Is there going to be discussion at the Bioneers Conference about alternative energy sources and whether or not they're actually viable now economically?
Well, there's a great deal of that, and it's very interesting to watch what's going on now politically, because actually large sectors of even big business have recognized that we cannot go on with the petrochemical metabolism, with the oil, game. And it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we're going to change. And a lot of these companies are actually furious at government regulation at this point, because the whole thing, is subsidizing fossil fuels. And if we just flipped those subsidies and had the equivalent of a Manhattan Project for renewables, we would solve a lot of problems all at once, including the fact that the U.S. economically is on our way to becoming a third world nation. And the way out of that, in my opinion, is towards something like a Green Deal, a Green New Deal, where we use the public purse to, just as we did with the computer industry, for example, to, the military developed that, to reboot the entire economy. So there are very strong business forces right now that are actually way ahead of the government on all this. And as you probably know, there's a backlog for solar panels. You can hardly buy one right now. So people have awakened to this. It's just, the oil industry and their corporate their government concubines who are in the way right now.
If there's a backlog for solar panels right now, doesn't that mean that there's an enormous opportunity to make some money?
That's exactly right, and that's a lot of what these companies are looking at now. So it's going to shift. But again, what we really need it to do is to reclaim government, to reclaim public policy. And the history of the great fortunes in this country is that they rely almost entirely on government policy and government subsidies.
For example?
Well, for example, the energy industry, $32 billion this year for an energy bill that basically subsidizes coal, oil, gas, and nuclear. The nuclear industry would have gone out of business 40 years ago, 50 years ago when it started, if not for government subsidy.
Right, if they weren't able to get insurance, for example. Reinsure the nuclear industry.
That's correct, and that's what Bush is pushing for now, is to make the public subsidize that, which is preposterous.
And what? But you said the historic fortunes, Rockefeller, Carnegie.
Sure. Look at the drug industry as we have it now. I mean, the new Medicare bill is basically these Medicare benefits are benefits for corporations,
right,
for the drug industry. Same with agriculture, $18 billion farm bill that's subsidizing corporate agribusiness.
Yeah, I would say, in fact, you could go back to John Rockefeller when he started pulling together these trusts, and the state of Ohio tried to kick him out because it was illegal what he was doing. And he said, okay, what states will change their laws to allow what I'm doing to become legal? And that was the beginning of the chartermongering era in the 1880s, 1890s. When Delaware and Connecticut and New Jersey and New York and all these other states started allowing corporate behavior that for 120 years at that point in the United States had been illegal. We're talking with Kenny Ossibel with Bioneers, bioneers.org, the website. Kenny, can you stick around for a minute?
Absolutely.
Great. I'd like to just touch on a couple of other topics if we can, and we got to take a break here. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm George W. Don't you cry for me. Now I've made it to the White House. That's in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, welcome back. Kenny Ossibel is with us. He's the co-founder of the Bioneers Conference, started out in 1990 at the Collective Heritage Institute, where he serves as the co-executive director with his partner and wife, Nina Simons. And am I pronouncing that right, Kenny?
You are.
And the Bioneers Conference has grown to be the preeminent gathering of social and environmental visionaries, attracting over 3,000 attendees last year. I was one of them. It's a heck of a conference. Bioneers.org, the website. Bill McKibben's going to be speaking on global warming coming up. Diane Wilson on being an unreasonable woman. That sounds fascinating.
It is fascinating, and there's this guy, Tom Hartman, that's going to be doing a plenary this year.
I'll be speaking there, too. Diane Wilson, I had her on this program. She's the woman who wrote the book about standing up to the chemical companies in Texas, right?
She is,
on the North Shore?
She's an extraordinary woman. You know, she's a high school graduate, mother of five, fourth-generation shrimp boat captain on the Texas Gulf Coast. And one day she was cleaning shrimp in the shrimp house about 15 years ago when a fellow shrimper who's dying of cancer came in and showed her the Houston Chronicle with a little article saying her little county, Calhoun County, population 15,000, was the most toxic in the country. And it blew her mind, and she started wondering if maybe it had something to do with the dolphin die-offs and the alligators floating belly up and the red tides and the brown tides. And she started holding meetings and started learning and started acting. And she's been single-handedly practically taking on the biggest chemical companies in the world there on the Gulf Coast and actually winning a lot of victories. She's extraordinary.
Yeah, it really, I'm looking forward to that. The ancient council ways, indigenous societies. You're going to be discussing this at the conference.
Well, I'm glad you asked about that. It's one of the most important and interesting. It's a woman who's actually Iroquois Native American or from Canada originally, Six Nations, who for 20 years has been living in Chiapas in southern Mexico, which of course is the stronghold now of the Zapatista movement. And she runs a health center in the area there. And what, of course, happened when, you know, on New Year's Day, 1994, is that 600 mostly Mexican Mayan Indians with a few AK-47s and some fake wooden rifles retook local power and created autonomous zones in Chiapas. And they said that NAFTA, you know, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which happened on that New Year's Day, 1994, was a death sentence for the indigenous.
And are they still holding that area?
They are. They have 38 autonomous zones now, and what they've done is to reinstitute indigenous council ways, what they call it. It's a completely different system of governance that's a real democracy. And the reason that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of Subcomandante Marcos, who became the spokesperson and was the military leader of this very brief armed struggle that ended 12 days after it began. They declared a ceasefire, and it's been purely nonviolent since then. They wore masks to be seen, and they carried guns to be heard, because otherwise they faced extinction.
But they've been portrayed in the media, particularly in the United States by and large, as radical Marxist, revolutionary, communist, bad guys, you know, Che Guevara wannabes, and I think pretty much everybody thinks they've gone away or they've been killed off.
Well, none of that is true, actually. And Marcos himself was a Mexican intellectual from a university before he went into the, you know, indigenous country. And he was a Marxist at that time, and he went in to organize the Indians. And instead, what they did is they organized him, and he came out what he calls scandalously Indian. And there are 2 million people now in southern Mexico who use the council ways, which is a community-based form of consensus decision-making, and is completely nonviolent, and they're a huge force in Mexico. They put the indigenous issue center stage in Mexico for the first time in 500 years to demand constitutional rights. But what they did is they invoked all of civil society to come to their defense and advocated that everybody deserves these rights, not only in Mexico but worldwide, and they helped to ignite a global movement, in fact.
So Okissimmee Forest, is that how you say it, her name?
Yeah, Okissimmee Forest, and she will be speaking about what's really going on in Chiapas today. And it's quite extraordinary. They've called for, you know, they say that the corporate world, globalization, is a death sentence, which it is for the world, both, you know, socially and economically and, of course, environmentally, and that people need to reclaim democracy worldwide. And that's exactly, they've been a beacon for that all over the world now. And, but they say they want a world where many worlds fit, not a world that's one giant company town.
Yeah, in many ways, the, we would be glad to assimilate you into our culture is the velvet glove over the iron fist of our culture.
Well, as Tom Friedman said, you know, you never, McDonald's operates hand in glove with McDonnell Douglas.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very violent class war.
Yeah. And we have just about a minute left. Bernice Johnson Regan?
Yeah. She's
talking about the evolution of African-American culture?
Well, yes, Bernice, probably many of your listeners would know her name because she's the founder of Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been involved in the civil rights movement since the beginning in the mid-1950s when she started attending some of the marches and the actions. And what she did is she began to sing. And, of course, song and music became really the driving force in many ways of the civil rights movement, along with, of course, the black churches. And she'll also be speaking on a panel with Tom Hayden about reclaiming faith, because, in fact, the church has often been a very progressive force, not only in this country in the civil rights movement, but in Latin America with liberation theology and worldwide. And there are many, many people of faith who are very good people of goodwill who are now rising up to reclaim faith.
Yeah, and a good thing it is. An important and vital thing it is. I mean, you could argue it all started, with the founders of each one of the respective faiths. Well, great. Kenny Isabel. Kenny is the co-founder of the Bioneers Conference, bioneers.org, bioneers.org for more information. Kenny, thanks for being with us today.
We'll see you at Bioneers.
I'll see you next month. Yes, indeed. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you understand the thing I'm feeling today? The button's pushed, there's no running away. No one's safe with the world in the gray. Take a look around you, boy. It's time to see the boy. You tell me over and over and over again, my friend.
Actually, the problem isn't so much that we don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. It's that there's a bunch of people in the Bush administration who think we are, and that's just a fine thing because it'll bring about the rapture. That's a little scary. Speaking as a Christian myself, I would say that's a little scary that anybody thinks that bringing about the end of the world is a good thing. Hey, Victoria Jones.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up? What's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, my goodness, I'm in the Rayburn House office building, and I'm actually hiding out in a real old-fashioned phone booth from the pre-cell phone days as the hearing into the Katrina debacle goes on the House side. And Michael Brown, former director of FEMA, is up before the committee, which is supposed to consist purely of Republicans because the Democrats boycotted it. However, Congressman Taylor from Mississippi and Congressman Jefferson from Louisiana have sat here like ghosts at the banquet for the entire proceeding so far and have both questioned Michael Brown really quite fiercely. But the fiercest questioner so far, and if you get a chance to watch the replay on C-SPAN, I recommend it, get the popcorn, Christopher Shays from Connecticut.
The Republican.
Ticked off, man. I mean, ticked off. He actually got Michael Brown to bang the table.
Really?
Yes, and he even got Michael Brown to have to consult his attorney. Very interesting line of questioning. First of all, part of what his issue was is that he said to Michael Brown, you call yourself a coordinator, and he basically is saying, well, you don't know how to coordinate, anything. And so Brown is obviously disagreeing with that. But here's the thing that I found interesting, Tom, and it could be something small and it could be conspiratorial, but let me just lay it out to you.
Please.
The question arises of when the White House was first spoken to by Michael Brown. And he was asked this by Christopher Shays, and this is when the lawyer stepped in, and they had to decide whether he could answer the question. And so he says, well, I talked to the White House. So Christopher Shays says, well, the White House is a big, it's a big place. Who? And he says, because he's asked, when did you first contact the president? He says, we talked Saturday and Sunday. And then he says, okay, so who did you email? He says, Andy Card, the president, and names one other person. And so basically he's saying Saturday and Sunday is when he first talks to the White House. Later on, under questioning from another congressman, and my notes are in shorthand, so it's difficult to read, he refers to conversations with Andy Card on Thursday and Friday.
The preceding, before Saturday and Sunday.
Before Saturday and Sunday, which seems to be when he's saying that he first had contact with the White House. Now, maybe he misspoke.
Yeah, or maybe he's referring to the Thursday and Friday after?
Maybe he is, but it didn't, in the context, it didn't sound like that. Yeah. I'm going to try and find out more about this, but this was the only occasion where the lawyer was called on.
Now, my understanding of his testimony, and I didn't watch it, I was on the air, but we have here in where I'm doing this show from, there are five radio stations here, and there's a news tank. There's a half a dozen news people here for the various stations, and there's like five TV screens going all at once and everything. And I was talking to one of the folks over there during the break at the top of the hour, and he said that basically what Michael Brown said was that it wasn't his fault, that he couldn't get the mayor and the governor to coordinate things with each other. He couldn't get them to talk to each other. He's so frustrated that these people are so incompetent, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Is that an accurate characterization of the you know, true story of his remarks?
Yes, it is. And it's also accurate that some of the Republicans on the committee are also following that line and are aiming to place the blame squarely on state and local officials. What Michael Brown also said in his statement, and this caused astonishment to more than one congressman, including two Republicans at least, was that when referring to mistakes that he made, rather than referring to real mistakes, what he refers to is the media and how he should have scheduled press conferences rather than letting the media drive it. That's one of the things he refers to. What's the other thing he referred to? My brain's gone blank. Oh, it was something very. Oh, the other thing he refers to is that the mayor and the governor in Louisiana couldn't get along. Now, those, it seems to me, are not exactly mistakes in terms of work that he has done wrong or that his agents have done wrong. Cite as examples.
Mm-hmm. So this is going to be the Republican story, that it's all about the fact that the mayor and the governor screwed up.
Well, some Republicans, but not all. I mean, Representative Tom Davis, who's the chairman of this committee from Northern Virginia.
Is this a House committee or is this a joint House-Senate committee?
This is a House committee.
Okay.
Because the Senate had said they didn't want to do it,
right,
unless they changed their mind. But there's no senators here.
Yeah.
So Tom Davis is relatively fair. Chris Shays has been pretty ticked off. Congresswoman Granger from Texas actually said to Brown, "I don't see how you can sleep at night."
Wow.
So there are Republicans who are not happy, but there are certainly others who would like to put the blame fully on state and local and move it as far from the White House as possible.
Is there any evidence that what he's saying, that is, that the major responsibility for this disaster lies with the governor and the mayor, is either true or is not true?
It's hard to say. It does sound to me more, listening today, that the mayor and the governor did not behave in an exemplary way. That is coming through to me. However, no, I don't think you can blame it on state and local, because we keep coming back to the fact that this was a catastrophe that was above and beyond anything that state and local would plan to coordinate or could possibly do.
We're physically capable of handling. I mean, this is the equivalent of somebody gets hit by a car, they're laying in the street unconscious, and some conservative walks by and says, don't pick them up, just let them be responsible for themselves.
Right. Now, Brown has also tried to offload some blame onto Michael Chertoff and the Department of Homeland Security, which isn't surprising, really, when it comes to procurement requests, because he basically seems to be saying that money that FEMA requested was written out of the budget request by Homeland Security, and so that the request, as far as he is aware, he seems to be saying, never actually went to Congress. So he's now blaming, I think this will come through at some point, he now seems to be blaming Chertoff for cutting funding before it went through to Congress.
Interesting. And Chertoff, of course, would have done that at the behest of the Bush administration.
I would presume that's possible.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. I'm sure that
there's
plenty of grist for the right-wing bloggers, and right-wing talk radio is going to be out there all over, every little soundbite that he offers about the governor and the mayor.
And he's already referenced horsesass.org, which I think is the blog that first said that he had been fired. So he's already been on at the blog.
Oh, interesting. You mean he, in his testimony, he referenced a blog?
In his written statement, he referenced the blog.
Is this a right-wing blog or a left-wing blog?
No, but I suspect it may be left-wing, because it's the one that seemed to be spreading the rumor that he'd already been fired very early on.
Interesting.
I'll
have to check it out. So where is this going? How long is it going to last?
Well, I think certainly the rest of the day, and I would think that they're going to want to hear from Governor Blanco and Mayor Nagin.
Yeah.
And if I was Blanco, I'd want to, unless I was totally screwed up, if I was Blanco, I'd want to get out there in front of that committee.
Yeah, yeah.
And put the record straight.
I would think so. Yeah, in fact,
I would think they would want to call Chertoff, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and let's hope so. Except that, again, this is a committee of, by, and for Republicans. It's the Republicans investigating the Republicans. And you know, oddly, when Republicans are investigating Republicans, there may be a little crack of truth coming out of it, but you're not going to get a whole bunch.
Right, exactly. And the fact that Jefferson from Louisiana and Taylor from Mississippi, both Democrats, are here sort of sitting on the other side of the aisle in what is an otherwise empty Democrat space. I think is testimony to their own outrage that they just felt they could not let this go by without having their own go at Brown, and they both have taken him on.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Victoria. Good talking with you.
Thank you. Thanks.
And thanks for the report from Washington, D.C. Scott in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Good. What's up?
I just wanted to let you know that I was at the rally on Saturday, and it was amazing, the sea of people that were there.
You were in Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Me and my daughter both took a trip. Local anti-war center, Thomas Morton Center, sponsored about. There was about four buses that left from the University of Pittsburgh and about seven buses that left from Carnegie Mellon University. Is where we left from. Just a quick statement about what your last guest was just speaking about. If the governor of Louisiana made a mistake and the mayor of New Orleans made a mistake, what mistake did Mississippi make that they didn't get any food or water or anything after the hurricane?
Yeah, well, it's...
That goes to show you the ineptitude of FEMA and the federal government, that they try and blame New Orleans when what happened to Mississippi? But I forgot, Haley Barbour's a Republican governor.
Yeah, yeah. And
they're not going to complain as loud as Louisiana.
Yeah, and here's the comments from Brown. He says, ironically, it started with an organization called horsesass.org that on some blog published a false and, frankly, in my opinion, defamatory statement that the media just continued to repeat over and over. Next, one national magazine not only defamed me, but my alma mater, the Oklahoma City University School of Law, in one sentence alone, leveling six false charges. He says, but I guess it's the media's job, but I don't like it. I think it's false. So I went over to horsesass.org, by the way, and checked it out, and they reprinted what they had originally said, which is, I think, what I read in, like, Time magazine, you know, that he ran the Arabian Horse Owners Association.
That's what he did. I just wanted to get you to comment on one more thing. I was just curious your opinion of the federal government giving all these large contracts to Halliburton, Kellogg Brown, and Ruth Bechtel, but yet, forgive me, I forget the name of the bill,
Davis-Bacon Act, yeah.
The prevailing wage. That goes to show to me that they don't care about the common man. They have all these millions.
Oh, they care a lot about the common man. They want to keep the common man, you know, under control.
Poor, exactly, poor.
Yeah.
They don't want to pay a prevailing wage.
Yep.
It's amazing to me.
Got a boogie, Scott. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If Henry Hyde got pregnant, abortions would all be safe and free. The national budget would have this new priority. Billions for health care and not 1 cent for bombs. Each month our clinics would receive a check from the Pentagon. If men could get pregnant.
Indeed. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. Michael Brown, the former director of FEMA, and
while FEMA was trying to respond
testifying
to probably the largest natural disaster in the history of this country, a catastrophic disaster that the president has described covering an area the size of Great Britain. I've heard 90,000 square miles. Unless you've been there and seen it, you don't realize exactly how bad and how big it was. But in the middle of trying to respond to that, FEMA's press office became bombarded with requests to respond immediately to false statements about my resume
so
and my background.
It was all the press's
Ironically,
fault.
It started with an organization called horsesass.org.
It was the blogger's
there
fault.
Was some blog published a false, and frankly, in my opinion, defamatory statement.
Yes, people died in New Orleans because a blogger lied about Michael Brown.
Next, one national magazine not only defamed me, but my alma mater, the Oklahoma City University School of Law.
Oh, and that's why people
in
died.
One sentence alone, leveling six false charges.
Oh, and that's definitely why people
job.
Died.
And I don't like it. I think it's false. It came at the wrong time. And I think it led potentially to me being pulled out of Louisiana because it made me somewhat ineffective.
So the media made Brown ineffective, and that's why people died in Louisiana. I get it now. Gee, I just didn't understand it before, but now I do. Thank you, Michael Brown, for clarifying that point for me. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Justin in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Hey, Justin.
I just wanted to know why so few Democrats were there at that hearing.
Because the Republicans said that they were going to run the hearing, they were going to decide who could be at the hearing, they were going to decide the agenda, they were going to decide the conclusion, they were going to write the report, and if some Democrats wanted to participate, they were welcome to, but they wouldn't have any power. And the Democrats said, under those rules, we're not going to play the game.
Okay, you're giving me a little civics or politics lesson here. How do they get to decide the rules like this?
Because they are the majority in the House of Representatives. Whichever party is in the majority in the House or the Senate gets to determine, they get to nominate or name the heads of the committees. And then when a committee does an investigation, the chairman of that committee, who will be from that party, gets to decide who's going to be on the committee and gets to determine who gets to speak when and how and all that sort of thing and gets to supervise the writing of the final report.
Yeah, just on the fly, it seems like they can, no matter what the situation, they can determine how to investigate it. It seems like we need maybe some affirmative action with our committees here.
Well, that's, historically, you look back over the history of Congress, and there have been times when the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the President have all been the same party. And those have been the times of, in some ways, the greatest change in America. For example, Franklin Roosevelt, when, he was able to pass things that 10 years before he came into power, the Supreme Court had declared unconstitutional. Minimum wage laws. The Supreme Court in the 19-teens, had declared them unconstitutional. Child labor laws. The Supreme Court said you can't interfere with business activities within the states. The right to unionize. It was passed 1935. Supreme Court has said you can't do that. So Roosevelt was able to push through things because he controlled all three branches. Similarly, Bush is pushing through things. He's radically reshaping America. And he's able to do it because he has a Republican majority in all three. Now, Roosevelt actually represented, and the Democrats in the 1930s represented clearly the will of the majority of Americans. They didn't have to lie to people. They didn't have to spin things. They didn't have to have a right-wing TV network out there and right-wing talk show hosts pushing for them. In fact, he had Father Coughlin, a right-wing radio commentator, going against him. Roosevelt did. Coughlin going, this is Roosevelt's going to lead us to, the doom. And so he represented the majority of the people. These guys, these Republicans in Congress, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the President, in my opinion, and in the opinion of most of the pollsters, they don't represent the majority of Americans. And as I've said many times, it's very clear that George Bush was not elected president in 2000. Even Jimmy Carter has now come out and said it, former president of the United States. And I don't believe he was elected president in 2004, for that matter. So, but in any case, they've got the majority. And unless you and I, Justin, unless you and I start getting politically active and get out there and participate and throw one of those houses, either the House or the Senate, into the hands of the Democrats so that somebody can be a balance. There's not going to be no balances to the checks and balances system that the founders envisioned when they set up this country.
It sure would be nice to hear Barry Sanders, Bernie Sanders there.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't think, as Victoria said, the only two Democrats who even showed up to sit in the room were the Democratic representatives from Louisiana and Mississippi, and I'm assuming that they felt that their loyalty to their people who were harmed by Michael Brown and by FEMA and by this administration transcended their outrage at the partisan way that Tom DeLay and Denny Hastert and the gang are running the House of Representatives.
Now, when Brown was confirmed, there was only five senators that showed up there. How is that allowable? How, and is that just something that happened because of apathy on the senators' part, or what?
Well, it was a Republican-controlled Senate. And you had the Republicans making the decision, and they figured, hey, it's no big deal. It's what the president wants. We'll give him what he wants.
And the Democrats didn't show up there either.
Well, I don't know, frankly. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look.
These Democrats are really peeing me off,
Well, see, I don't think that they should have shown up. What they did was essentially an act of civil disobedience. This is not the Democrats failing to stand up for themselves. This is the Democrats making it very clear that this thing is a charade. If the Democrats had participated in this and played by the rules of the Republicans, then the Republicans, when all was said and done, could say, okay, Michael Brown, no fault. Bush administration, no fault. It's all those Democrats in Louisiana, the governor and the mayor, it's all their fault. And the Democrats who had participated would be essentially, you know, by being there, would be implying that they agreed with that. And the Democratic, you know, the Democrats, I think, very wisely are saying, we're not gonna have any part of this charade, because that's what it is. It's a charade. And on it goes, by the way. And thanks for the call, Justin. I mean, this kind of charade, it's time for us in America to say, enough already. Just like, and let me remind you one more time, enough already with John Roberts. Call Pat Leahy at 1-202-225-3121. 202-225-3121. Let him know what you think about John Roberts, among other things.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to our radio program here, broadcasting live from coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org and CRN Digital. Tom Hartman with you. Our program this hour brought to you by EcoWine, 1-888-ECOWINE, 1-888-ECOWINE. Is it constitutional for mercenaries to be walking around in devastated parts of New Orleans, patrolling the streets and policing Americans? Michael Ratner's with us. Michael is with the, he's the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, the website ccr-ny.org. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so pleased to have you here, Michael. The last time we talked, in fact, if my recollection serves me right, it was about a half a year ago, more or less, and you were involved in a lawsuit against Don Rumsfeld in Germany?
Yeah, still am working on that case, which is trying to get some kind of investigation of high U.S. officials for torture at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And, of course, my office represents the Guantanamo detainees as well. And now we're looking into the situation in New Orleans with these mercenaries is the best word I can use for them.
Yeah, well, just to wrap up the Guantanamo thing, where does all that stand right now?
Well, we're in a huge amount of litigation. We still have a number, hundreds of people left in Guantanamo. But luckily, the legal community, we have some 450 lawyers now trying to get access to people, seeing them, trying to get them released. But we're all, you know, we're really, to be honest, we're all caught up in the courts, although we're putting huge pressure on the government. And for how long they'll be able to keep Guantanamo open, I think, is anybody's guess. I don't think if we have this conversation 6 months or a year from now, they'll still be keeping that place open.
Well, let's hope not. I mean, I think a lot of Americans are coming around to the point of view that if the government actually has evidence that a person that they're holding is a criminal, or even worse, a terrorist, or a truly an enemy combatant, that they should present that evidence in a court of law and prosecute that person, give that person an opportunity to defend themselves. I mean, we did this with the Nazis at Nuremberg. You know,
that's exactly what we're asking for. We're saying that everybody who's imprisoned by the United States deserves a trial before you throw the key away. And that's what we've said, and that's why there's actually the most serious thing going on in Guantanamo now is a hunger strike. And there's people who are being forcibly fed in the hospital, and some, if we can get access to them, we'll be able to figure out exactly their condition, but we've heard stories of people close to death. And their demand is not to be released. Their demand is really saying, I want a trial. I want a fair trial.
Yeah, I want to prove my innocence, or for that matter, probably a few of them, or maybe a few of them, even want to brag about their guilt if they really believe that their cause was a noble one and they actually were combatants caught on the field of battle.
You know, that we just don't know.
You know, the Patrick Henry syndrome.
Right, exactly. We just don't know. We do know that anecdotally, and we probably represent a couple hundred people, is that a lot of these people shouldn't be there. Some of them may have been caught up on a battlefield, but we so far haven't come across someone who's a bomb thrower.
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. Okay, so now we find that there are, not only in Iraq, are there, you know, Blackwater and other companies providing private mercenary armies, basically. The second largest army in Iraq is not the British Army, it's the private contractors, so-called contractors, the mercenary armies. Some estimate 20,000 people. Is that an accurate number, do you think?
Yeah, you know, very few people know what you just said. It's a really important number, though, that it's actually, there's U.S. forces and the British, and then the second biggest is the private army, which is anywhere from 15 to 20,000. It's so extraordinary, really.
Yeah, so before we get to New Orleans, the question in my mind, I keep hearing about these Blackwater and other mercenaries. For example, the Blackwater guys were in Fallujah, the four guys who got killed and their bodies were defaced, or whatever the appropriate word is, on the bridge and whatnot, you know, hung out and desecrated, I guess would be the word, that then led to this massive retaliatory strike against Fallujah, basically, you know, half destroying the city by American. That we still don't know to this day why those guys were in Fallujah, do we?
No, we just don't know what's going on. I mean, when you look at the mercenaries that are being used in Iraq, you have to ask yourself a lot of questions. At first, they're getting $1,000 a day. So you have them fighting side by side with U.S. soldiers who are whatever they're getting. I don't even know, but it certainly isn't $1,000 a day. If it's $50 a day, it's lucky.
Yeah.
So you have this incredible situation where we're spending huge amounts of a budget on essentially paying mercenaries. Now, what's interesting...
Why would we do that?
Well, I think what people are beginning to realize, we have a shortage of trained military people in this country.
Oh, but it's got to go beyond that. I mean, is there something that we're doing that we really don't want anybody to know
about?
Well,
that's one, a shortage. Secondly, I think that these people are not accountable in the way military are, to the extent they are, through chains of command, and there's sort of no way you can get at them. So after, you know, we saw that some private interrogators were involved in torture in Iraq, there was really sort of no law that applies to them. That's the second one.
And they never pursued that, did they?
That's right. Never pursued.
We still don't know who those private contractors were that were involved in Abu Dhabi.
Well, we have a suit against two sets of them, but, you know, it's in the middle, it's in the beginning stages, and those are Titan and Khaki. But in terms of individuals, a few names were mentioned, but we really don't have the story on that. And a third reason, when you look at the origin of all of this stuff, it goes back to 1991 when Cheney, whatever his position was, I guess at Pentagon, did a study and said maybe we should start using mercenaries. And, of course, the first people, when he took over Halliburton, that were hired were people from Halliburton.
Right.
So
wasn't
the question
Cheney...
that's private gain come in here at all? I don't know.
Right. Wasn't Cheney Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration?
That's correct.
Yeah, he had Don Rumsfeld job.
So that's probably when he did the study, and then he takes over Halliburton, and they send the first mercenaries to Iraq. But I think your point was a really good one. It's one I hadn't thought through exactly. What do these guys do? They're not trained in the Geneva Conventions and in the same way the U.S. soldiers are. And are they just really acting essentially as rogue thugs is the best way? And they may be done purposely. I mean, one of the messages the Americans or the U.S. government may want to send is we are out of control. We will treat you with rogue thugs, and therefore don't pick up any arms again.
Well, this is what we did in El Salvador. I mean, it's like wherever John Negroponte goes, 6 months later or 3 months later, you start finding, you know, half a dozen corpses here, half a dozen there with all bullet wounds to the head and signs of torture. And, you know, it happened immediately after he got down to Central America, and it happened immediately after he got to Iraq as our ambassador to Iraq. I mean, could it be that Negroponte went in and helped set this thing up?
My view is Negroponte is key in all of this stuff. He was key when he was the ambassador to Honduras. He was really running that war in Nicaragua.
El Salvador.
This guy is someone who they put in, I think, for the dirty jobs. And I think that may well have happened in Iraq. And I think that we should not look at these things as abuses or aberrations. I think when you link it to Negroponte and link it to others, what we're really saying here, this is an intentional policy of these administrations because they want to basically strike terror in people. And unfortunately, it has the reverse effect and builds up just tremendous hate against the U.S.
Against the United States. So now we have this happening in Central America and in Iraq. And in fact, I had a caller this morning who had been in Iraq, and it was a GI, and he said that when the Blackwater guys showed up, and we had another caller from New Orleans who said the same thing. When they show up, they're wearing more weapons than God. I mean, they're more decked out in armament than Arnold Schwarzenegger in his movies. and that, you know, that now these guys are in New Orleans. Armed mercenaries in American cities?
It's an amazing thing. You know, I mean, Jeremy Scale is the writer who put this article into The Nation and some other media outlets, and it's the first real article that came out about it, so we're just sort of getting our hands around it. But what there are now is Blackwater is in New Orleans. There's other mercenary groups in New Orleans as well. They're wearing full battle gear. They're carrying what appears to be automatic weapons, AR-15s, which are assault rifles.
Which are illegal in the United States.
Which should be. It's my understanding is they're illegal. And I don't think there's any dispensation to carry them. And they've been given instructions, or they're telling Jeremy or telling people, that we're here to secure neighborhoods and confront criminals. Now, you know, there's a million ways you can approach what's going on here, but the idea that these guys are in our American cities is remarkable to me. And think about if you were a African-American in New Orleans, what happened, you know, through vigilantism, through lynchings, through these very kinds
of multi-generationally.
Exactly right, multi-generationally, and these people are walking through your streets, supposedly to secure neighborhoods. What's their chain of command? What's their training? Why are they there? They're not police. They're not National Guard. We don't know. They claim they're under federal contract. They claim they might be guarding some federal sites. But why? Why are they there? What's going on here with essentially a private army of mercenaries in New Orleans?
And is it an army that's responsible to or responsive to or hired by the administration, by the executive branch, by Congress, by the Republican National Committee? Michael, we've got to take a break, but can you stick around?
Sure.
Because I want to get into this a little more, and also this Operation Granite Shadow. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not, actually.
Okay. Well, it's about a three-minute break. If you can Google it quickly, there's a Washington Post story on it. But it's all this whole larger realm of the militarization of America by the Bush administration is getting really, really spooky. And it's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Harpin.
If you're out of a job and your pension's been robbed, well, it's no act of God. You've been bushwhacked.
Oh, you have been.
You were 40 plus, but you're still going bust because your rent's going up. You've been bushwhacked. You've been bushwhacked, Jack,
and welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin, and we're talking with Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, the website. And, Michael, we had gotten up to the point where we're talking about the Blackwater contractors in New Orleans, and it sounds like nobody knows who's paying these guys. Nobody knows who they're accountable to. In the press today, in the media, not just today, but over the last couple of days, there's been George Bush coming out and suggesting that the device or the agency or the vehicle or whatever of first response in the case of another national disaster should be the military. And, you know, my knowledge of the military is that, you know, in the military, you're trained to kill people and blow things up. And you're not trained like police are to respect constitutional rights and the rule. I mean, the military police to a certain extent, but they're operating under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is a different set of laws and which actually suspends many constitutional rights. How is it that Bush would even contemplate, first of all, violating posse comitatus and deploying the military in the United States? And secondly, how do we get from that to private mercenaries? Have we gone? Whoa. Oh, sorry, Michael. Forgot to push the button. You're back on.
Yeah, those are absolutely critical questions, Tom. I mean, what we're facing here really is, I think, trying to get the American people used to essentially military people in camouflage and with guns walking around the streets and making it look, reminds me of Spain when I visited during Franco's period in the early 70s or late 60s, you know, when Franco was there, and that's what you saw all over the streets. And your questions are good. What, I mean, first of all, they're not trained. I mean, military alone are not trained, but can you imagine then these private mercenaries? They're not trained in constitutional rights, how to protect people, when to arrest people, when, you know, all of these kinds of things. Police, and they still, you know, abuse that power a lot. police at least are trained in constitutional rights and understand that.
And they have internal systems for, you know, internal departments that investigate them when they screw up. I mean, there's a checks and balance system within police departments, even if it's imperfect, at least it's there.
And we can sue them, and they have civilian complaint review boards, and they're in the city, and they're living in the area. I mean, it's a whole difference. I agree. Completely different. We can have, there's abuses in there, but there isn't what happens when you put military in and then mercenaries.
So, Michael...
So that's why we have the Posse Comitatus Act, which is supposed to prohibit military in this country.
Right, from the 1870s.
Right.
So am I, like, climbing out on a George Norrie, you know, way out here in outer space limb when I look around and it seems to me like this administration is hell-bent for leather on militarizing the United States and stripping us of our constitutional rights?
You know, it seems that way to me. When I see my kid taking a subway and there's four or five guys lolling about in their camouflage uniforms with guns sitting at the edge of the subway, that makes me very, very nervous. And when I see mercenaries in particular in American cities, that really draws home an important lesson, I think, because when you talk about, you don't want to throw words around lightly like fascism and stuff like that, but when you get basically a private security forces out on our streets, it reminds you, you know, in your way, of black shirts or people who carried out the policies of dictators in Hitler's Germany.
Hitler did it. I mean, the original brown shirts were not part of the government. They were answerable to the party and not to the government. And that's why I'm wondering who's paying the salary of these Blackwater guys. Is it the Republican National Committee? Is it some private corporation affiliated with them? I mean, that's how they did it in Munich in the late 20s and early 30s.
That's why this is such a huge step to me. Huge. This is major what they're doing with these mercenaries. And yes, some of them are probably being paid from what we can see in some of the articles, the few articles there have been, very few, by FEMA, you know, our Federal Emergency Management Organization. But to do what, we don't know. Some are being paid by private wealthy people. Some are being paid by hotel owners. We don't know. I mean, we just don't know. But these people are now all over New Orleans.
And this is just spooky. Michael, we have a minute and a half. How are we going to find out? What can people do about this? What should we, the people, be doing?
Well, we should be demanding, I think, at our local level, of our congressmen to begin to make inquiries immediately. What's going on in New Orleans? Why are there private security there? Why is Blackwater there? Some of the congresspeople have actually begun to say, what is this? What is going on here? I mean, why? Why we can't police our own cities anymore?
Is our country being stolen from under us?
I mean, so I think that's a first level. A second level, I guess, is to, you know, read what's out there, write letters, go to your editorial board, say, let's do an investigation, let's do something about this. And then as we go on here, of course, places like the center will be thinking about lawsuits, but that's only one kind of method here of getting at it. What you've really got to do is people have to wake up and recognize what's going on in the country with the militarization of all of our cities.
Yeah, we have gone so far down this road, and I think that, you know, we had gone quite a ways down the road with our little Reichstag-Gebüge incident, you know, 9/11, when 2-3 years ago, whatever it was, I first published that article that drew those parallels, and people were like, whoa, you know, can't be.
Right.
Now it's like conventional wisdom. Okay, yeah, Bush exploited that the same way Hitler did. Is this the playbook? I mean, it's
the playbook, and they're now exploiting Katrina like that so they can begin to militarize even more and use the idea that Blackwater is walking around the city streets of New Orleans. I mean, you know, they really, in one way, of course, they want to get people used to it, but they also want to drive African Americans out of New Orleans. I mean, that's pretty clear. That's one of the agendas.
Yeah, flip that blue state red quick.
Right.
Yeah, amazing. Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights, www.ccr-ny.org, the website. Is that the best website for you, Michael?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much for being with us, Michael Ratner, Center for Constitutional Rights. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The radio support group of, by, and for We the People, where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, don't think so.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Watch out for me, woman, and don't mind nobody else.
And welcome back.
Watch out for me, woman, and don't mind nobody else. Ain't got no crystal ball, but the future ain't hard to tell.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 35 minutes past the hour. And our number 1-866-889-8894 here on the True People's Radio. David in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, honored to talk to you. I love your show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
Yes, you know, I mean, look at how secretive this administration has conducted itself in the last 5 years. And I don't know if you watched that Frontline about the private warriors.
Yeah, is something recent, or is this like 6 months or a year?
Yeah, it was in the last few months, but they were going over, you know, those mercenaries that you were describing, how they were instructed not to talk to the media. I mean, not one word.
Right. It's a violation of your contract. If you do, you lose all your money, and you can be sued, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Exactly. So here's the military that we're supposed to be supporting, the troops and all that. You know, and alongside, here's these private warriors that are totally decked out in these Darth Vader-looking outfits with all the weapons that they could dream of. You know, and here's the U.S. military soldiers just standing there with their hands in their pockets, like, why do they have all the weapons and we don't?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the resentment and the animosity that creates, because they don't have any chain of command, like you were mentioning earlier.
Well, that's the larger issue. The real issue here is, in a democracy, the government has to be answerable to the people. And there have to be constraints on the government. The primary purpose of the Constitution and the primary purpose of most, at least early legislation, was not to control and regulate we the people. It was to control and regulate government behavior, is to limit the power of government.
That's right. And the money that they're being paid. I mean, what an insult to, you know, the U.S. military, especially the non-commissioned as part of the military.
Right,
which raises
the question. Why do you have to pay somebody $1,000 a day? What is it that they're doing that is so hard to find people who are willing to do that you have to pay $1,000 a day for it? Because if we were just looking for people to fill out the ranks of our soldiers, if this was all about Don Rumsfeld and George W. Bush saying, you know, we've got 120,000 soldiers in Iraq, we really need 150,000, we're not going to be able to recruit those additional 30,000, so we'll just hire people.
They're so full of it. Oh
yeah,
my God.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that they could hire people to be private mercenaries, whatever you want to call it, for $40,000 to $50,000 a year. I mean, that's big money in a lot of America.
That's right, and make up these stories, you know, and with this whorish media that's delivering these stories that there's, oh, we have a shortage in the military. They're so full of it because they're hiring privately anyways.
Right, and so what is it that these guys are doing that you have to pay somebody $150,000 a year to do? I just, you know, I don't get it. And then why, you know, whose dollars, why are our tax dollars being taken and being used to pay somebody $150,000 a year to behave in a way that's unaccountable to us and is bringing about things like Abu Ghraib when we don't have control over it? And that's the whole point of, you know, the government, you know, spending should be accountable to we the people. And then showing up in our own cities, in New Orleans. I mean, what is going on here?
Can you believe it? And to top it all off, the $8.5 billion other money that's being missed. That's missing in Iraq.
Just vanished. It's incredible.
I mean, how do we know that that money is not being redistributed amongst the Republican Party and these private mercenaries, you know, to fund their little secretive plans that they have for, you know, in carrying out this Project for a New American Century, whatever they're doing.
You know, I don't for a minute think that money simply vanished. $8.5 billion doesn't vanish.
Oh, yeah.
It ends up somewhere, and I guarantee you it didn't end up in the hands of the local Iraqi who's the cook for the 82nd Infantry or whatever, airborne or whatever it is. That money went someplace. It went someplace real.
They're so annoying. And, you know, Tom, really, one final point. They remind me of an annoying bug that will not go away. You just smash this mosquito against the wall, and it just reanimates itself.
Yeah, well, I got to say, David, this is a whole lot more and a whole lot worse than a bug. This is a whole lot. You know, we're talking about the future of democracy in a republic. We're talking about a country being taken over, a country being occupied by a military force that's being paid by somebody, and we don't know who that somebody is. We don't know what their rules of engagement are. We don't know what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. I mean, this is a real threat to democracy. We have laws against our military doing this. The Posse Comitatus Act that was passed back in the 1870s after the Civil War, we said never again will an army in the United States be used against civilians. And now George Bush wants to change that, too. He wants to say, well, you know, if we have a natural disaster, let's bring in the army. Well, it sounds nice when you see the National Guard guys coming in and they're delivering water and food. I mean, isn't that sweet? But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about taking control. And the National Guard, I mean, the National Guard, you can deploy National Guard within a state, but only by the authority of the governor of that state. There are checks and balances with the National Guard that cause the National Guard not to violate posse comitatus. And sometimes it goes too far. Look what happened at Kent State in Ohio back in the 1970s, where the Guard actually fired on students and killed four of them. But mind-boggling. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Well, first of all, I want to know, if nobody knows who these people are, they don't answer to anyone, and there was a confiscation of guns put into New Orleans, why doesn't the local mayor confiscate the guns off of these people and find out who they are, who's paying them, and what they're doing? They're armed in their streets while the National Guard are there. Not only that, I look at the Constitution of what the president did already, and I'm wondering myself why Congress and Senate doesn't impeach him for, number one, confiscation of guns, where under the Second Amendment you're allowed, and the other...
Where's the NRA in all this?
You know what, Tom, I want to tell you, I am a member of the NRA, okay? And soon as I heard that, the first time that they confiscated guns, when I saw that old woman having her pistol taken off her, I called the NRA, and they slammed the phone down on me.
They didn't want to hear about it.
They didn't want to hear about it.
Oh, that's
I said, why do you pick an administration like this telling us he's going to protect our Second Amendment rights when he's the one destroying it?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the reason why you're not going to have the House of Representatives investigate this is because Tom DeLay and the Republicans are in charge of it. The reason the Senate's not going to investigate it because Bill
Frist... I want
Frist
to ask you another question.
And the Republicans... Yeah, but let me just finish this rant. Because Bill Frist and the Republicans are in charge of it. And the reason the NRA is probably not going to say anything about confiscating guns in New Orleans is because it's a Republican administration, and the NRA really doesn't represent the interests of its members. The NRA is really a trade association for weapons manufacturers, and they know which side their bread is buttered on.
Well, you know what? We as citizens of the United States, we believe in it. Otherwise, we would have never went into the service, you know, ourselves. If we didn't have the protection of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, we didn't have nothing. But we went in and we protected that all through the years now. And now here we have two draft dodgers. You know, Cheney made the statement five times that he had his priorities higher than going into the draft. And
yes.
Bush, whatever they get out of that, you know, the National Guard stuff and that. But here's
he went
guys.
AWOL during time of war. That's something that they execute people
guys.
For.
And his dad was in charge of the CIA. Now, you figure out what's going on down there. Like you said earlier, you know, Mississippi and that's a different story because they're not all highly democratic, populated areas. So they're going to do whatever they want. But you don't hear nothing about that Roe guy. You don't hear nothing about, well, DeLay, yeah, come on. But look who you have investigating him, Melissa Hart from Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They call her Malicious Hart up here.
Well, what DeLay has to worry about really is, what's his name, Ronnie? I'm forgetting the guy's last name. The prosecuting attorney down there in Texas. And, you know, this guy who has successfully prosecuted, by the way, more Democrats than Republicans in his career. And he's the guy who's coming after Trimpac. And that's I think, is going to be Tom DeLay's Achilles heel.
Yeah.
But by and large, you're absolutely right. The Republicans are not going to investigate Republicans. And you know, spot on, Jim, and well said. And you know, good question. Where is the NRA? Why is the NRA not saying, hey, wait a minute, they took away all the guns of the people in New Orleans, and then these guys come in with full automatic weapons? I mean, could it be? Wayne in Seattle on the line. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think you're a hit here in Seattle. I'm so glad you're on the airwaves. You're an elite club of hosts who are on live. Basically, I've been watching this C-SPAN hearing with the 10 Republicans and the 2 Democrats and a press conference by the Democrats calling for an independent commission. But I question the whole concept of whether either an independent commission or a congressional committee can arrive at the truth. I mean, you look back to the Warren Commission, what questions they were set up to ask, and David Ray Griffin has written a critique of the 9/11 commission. There are 9/11 families who feel that there are still questions the commission didn't deal with.
Yeah, quite a few of them, by the way.
Yeah, and so,
quite a few questions. I mean, quite a few 9/11 families as well.
Right, and so I question the whole premise. I mean, of whether even what the Democrats are calling for is going to get us at the truth of this matter.
Yeah. Well, here's my take on this, and Wayne. And number one. with regard to the 9/11 Commission, again, you had essentially Republicans investigating Republicans. You know, Tom Keene was a Republican governor of New Jersey, I believe it was. Long history with the Republican Party. I mean, and he was essentially in charge of the thing. Yeah, he had a co, you know, Bob Kerry had a co-chair. Yes and no, really. So I'm just, you know, the 9/11 Commission thing, again, to me, I think a lot of the conclusions were basically Republican whitewash. Plus, there was a big chunk of it, about a third of it, that is still to this day classified. That is still classified.
Right.
They just declassified a little bit of it 2 weeks ago, and some of the papers that came out as the result of a lawsuit pointed out that the Bush administration had been told before 9/11 that Al-Qaeda was planning on hijacking airplanes and flying them into high-profile buildings in New York City. And it made absolutely, I mean, you know, nobody in the media even mentioned it. And I mean, it got, you know, little notice here and there in some of the newspapers. But it's like, this is screaming news. So anyhow, I'll tell you about the Warren Commission when we come back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror. Yeah, we wanna give up. Sometimes you don't even want to try. Sometimes we cry.
And then sometimes we just get really, really upset and get out there and fight and say, that's it. Enough already. We've had it. Or as good old what's his name? You know, I am mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I mean, there has to be a point where you just say enough already. Enough. And I really think that America is just about there. I mean, it's just about there. You've got Franklin Roosevelt comes along, you know, 60, 70 years ago and passes things like Social Security, minimum wage protections, unemployment insurance, establishes the foundations for Medicare, and which LBJ then puts into place. So Roosevelt comes along and puts these things into place, and now they're absolutely under assault from the conservatives.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we're doing something about that as well. That nasty Roosevelt with his nasty Social Security. How dare he? We're going to do something about that. You just, you know, don't, you know. And while it's all going on...
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
No, not, don't even look. 1-866-889-8894. Janine in New York City. Hey, Janine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Boy, you're really doing a good thing. I thank you so much for your great work.
Thank you.
I just have a question. I can't understand why there's no special prosecutor dogging George Bush like Ken Starr was after Bill Clinton.
Because when Bill Clinton was president, the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, and so they could initiate investigations, and they could raise enough noise, and they could keep the political pressure on and threaten to shut down Congress if Clinton didn't agree to have the Department of Justice, you know, part of the executive branch, nonetheless, install a special prosecutor. Also, Clinton thought he didn't have anything to fear. I mean, you know, he knew that he hadn't done anything wrong with the Whitewater thing, and so, you know, yeah, go ahead and investigate it. And you know, it just, you know, Ken Starr, the thing, you know, spun out of control. Ken Starr, the mentor to John Roberts, by the way, and you know, so. The reason that there's no special prosecutor now is because the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House, and the court system.
Oh, that's so awful.
Well, it is not the checks and balances that the founders envisioned. And those times in America, you know, several times in American history, we've had this sort of thing happen, and it usually is not good. It's sometimes arguable, but I'd say right now, clearly, the majority of Americans don't want our national parks privatized and sold off. They don't want our air made dirtier. They don't want our water less safe. They don't want our food supply less safe. They don't want our drug supply less safe. They don't want corporations basically raping, robbing, and pillaging this nation on behalf of inherited wealth and big multinational corporate interests. And so.
Well put. Exactly right.
Yeah. Janine, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
We need to get active. I keep saying it. We need to get active. It's the bottom line. Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott.
Well, good morning, Tom. I've been listening to your program for a couple of weeks and thought I'd better call in. You know, I read a quote today that really, really struck a deep chord. It says, "A fool flatters himself, the wise man flatters the fool." So I called in today to flatter George W. Bush because he's such a negative role model for me.
Okay.
I think of things like I'd better show a better work ethic, or I'm going to end up like George W. Bush.
Yeah. Well,
I get involved in politics, or George W. Bush will take apart my country.
Yeah.
I'd look more closely at our morals in the public space about people being starving and women suffering, etc. And I remind myself that George Bush shows me what morals are not. Morals are demonstrated in the public space and not in the private mind. So he's such a great negative example for me, Tom. I just had to tell you that.
Okay, Scott. Yeah, don't do that.
Exactly. Or you'll end up just like him.
Yeah, well, see, in order to end up just like him, number one, you'd have to be born into a multi-millionaire family, you know, a dynastic family. Number two, you'd have to have a father who is the head of the CIA, had been in the CIA for some 40 years, and who ultimately would become president of the United States. And number three, and perhaps most important, you'd have to have somebody like Karl Rove. Karl Rove describes the moment that he met. He was working for Bush Sr., and he went down to the train station to meet Bush Jr., had just come into town. And Bush Jr. comes in with his tight blue jeans and his blue denim Western jacket on.
Jacket, and immediately fell in love with a guy and wanted to hang out with him forever.
That's the phrase he used. He said he fell in love with George W. Bush.
Fell in love with.
Yeah, and that's what you would have to have, is you would have to have somebody who was an absolutely amoral political hack who was willing to spin America in any direction you wanted, and who was willing to follow you to the ends of the earth and suck up to your family's money. And that's, you know, odds are, Scott, you don't have it. But, you know, and it's a good thing. You know, hopefully there's not a lot more Karl Roves out there. Janice in Pittsburgh, we just have about a minute left. What's up, Janice?
Okay, I just wanted to say that in addition to organizing politically, we have to also do it with our dollars. So, of course, stay out of places like Walmart. But also working assets allows you to call Washington for free every day.
Yes, if you have your long-distance service with Working Assets, it's workingassets.com or workingassets.org, do you know?
I think it's .com, but it's an 800 number. I know that.
Yeah.
I've been with them forever.
I'm sure if you just Google Working Assets, you can get it. If you have a long-distance service with them, then you get two unlimited?
What they do is they allow you to call Washington every day for free, but they also give you two important bills that are in front of Congress, and they give you the whole synopsis of it, and then they give you the number you can call, and you can call that for free, and they also give you a follow-up as to how your senator and congressperson were voted.
That's marvelous.
So, okay.
That's absolutely marvelous. Working assets. Janice, thanks
okay.
a lot.
Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you. So, you know, there's a lot of good people out there doing a lot of good stuff. People getting active. And that's what it's going to take to bring democracy back to the United States, to recover the ideals upon which this nation was founded and the values that we've always held dear, and take them back from these right-wing cranks who, by deception and wedge issues and, frankly, outright lies, you know, the swift voting of America, and who knows what they've been doing with the voting machines and disenfranchisement of largely African Americans, have stolen power in this country. We need to take it back. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.